Good morning and welcome to the California Coastal Commission meeting for March 13th, 2009. Could we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Ashajian.
Here.
Commissioner Blank.
Here.
Commissioner Burke. Commissioner Clark.
Present.
Commissioner Secor.
Present.
Commissioner Mercurimi.
Present.
Commissioner Schellenberger.
Here.
Commissioner Wan.
Here.
Chair Neely.
Here.
You have a quorum.
All right, thank you. And before we go to staff for agenda changes, I want to go to Commissioner Mercurimi, who has an announcement or an introduction to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, I am honored to welcome my alternate, the Mayor of Sebastopol, Sarah Gurney. I understand that Mayor Gurney will also be sworn in, and I just want to welcome Mayor Gurney, Commissioner Gurney, alternate, to this wonderful opportunity.
All right, and now let's do any comments from staff, or shall we just go to the changes? Mr. Douglas?
Bob will go through the changes, and then I have a couple of comments before we start.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. There are two changes to the agenda today. On page 14, item 7A, which is appeal number A1 SNC 98-114, the SNG Development Company project, that's been postponed. And then on page 15, item 12A, which is the application of PG&E 1-08-37, has been postponed. And I'll just indicate a couple of announcements for those of you in the audience. If you wish to address the commission today on any of the items, you'll need to fill out a speaker slip, which is on the table at the entrance to the building here, and give the completed slip to a staff member. The table also contains addenda for items on today's agenda that people can peruse if they wish. And finally, if people would please turn off their cell phones or put them in an operable mode so we do not disturb the meeting.
Yes, Madam Chair, we will need a closed session today at the end of the agenda. Something came up yesterday that warrants us going into a brief closed session.
All right, great. Thank you for letting us know.
I also want to call to your attention, I think it's now back a couple of years ago, I was approached by a Richard Ocean, who is a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, to do an interview about the good things that the Coastal Commission does. I consented to that interview. They came to the office and filmed a number of questions that they asked me and answers. Subsequent to that, I found out that they have put together a documentary called Sins of Commission. That is making its rounds. I have not seen it, but the people that have said it is such a biased hatchet job, trashing the Coastal Commission, accusing you of essentially killing one of the people who the commission had an enforcement action against, causing the fires in Malibu, in other words, bringing about the end of the earth, and selectively editing comments from me that clearly make it out to be that I'm out to destroy people's property rights. I gave them a written permission to use my image in my interview. I withdrew that written permission. They do not have legal permission to use my responses in those interviews. I'm not taking any legal action because, in my view, there is something about the First Amendment and other kinds of issues here. But I just want you to be aware of it because that they've been trying to find somebody to actually run it. I don't think they have because it is so clearly biased and such a hatchet job. Most of the people involved with it are people against whom the commission has enforcement action. In fact, the people who put it together were in litigation with them. But it is making its rounds, and it is being used to discredit the commission and its staff, accusing you of running amok, destroying people's private property rights. I wanted you to be aware of it because you'll hear about it, I'm sure, from some people by word of mouth. But I also want to make clear that those people who've seen it clearly see it as a biased hatchet job against the commission and give it no credence. But I wanted you to be aware of it. With that, Madam Chair, we can go on to the regular agenda here.
Mr. Douglas?
Yes.
On the issue of that film, I haven't seen the whole thing, but I have seen some of the clips. And the quotes from the people who are in there are all people who have not only violations, these aren't violations pending. These have gone to court where they've lost. Okay, in the one case, huge fines. Matter of fact, Mr. Starks was here a couple of months ago saying that he didn't understand why this whole thing wasn't resolved, except that it was resolved. The courts have issued him huge penalties, and he hasn't paid them. So everyone in that film, including the filmmakers, are associated with legal action and so it's clearly biased because these are all the people who went out and did what they shouldn't have done, mostly in the Santa Monica Mountains, actually. As a matter of fact, two of the three are in the Santa Monica Mountains. And I am just appalled at what's going on.
Let the record show that one of the people in that film doesn't have a violation action against him, and that's me.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that update.
All right. I don't have a copy of it. It's not... You know. Well, with that, there is... On the first item, that's the Energy and Ocean Resources Federal Consistency, I do have one de minimis waiver to report. It's before you. It's doing some testing, surveying off the city of Santa Cruz relative to a potential desalination operation there. We have found no coastal resource impacts and approved a waiver. De minimis waiver, so unless commissioners object, that waiver will go into effect.
Let me just check and see if there are any objections to concurrence with this item. Seeing none, the commission concurs.
All right, then that brings us to the next item, which is both a coastal development permit. This is item 5A, the AT&T fiber optic cable project offshore San Luis Obispo and out to sea over to Hawaii. We did hand out an addendum for that item. I believe that went out yesterday. Some minor changes, some issues that were brought to our attention after the staff report was completed. We've made those changes. AT&T has agreed to those and are in full agreement with the staff recommendation. I just want to point out one aspect of this that I've had some calls on. And that is that we have conditions attached to this fiber optic cable project that relate to impacts on public recreational resources. And we worked out an agreement with AT&T that they will provide $50,000 or $55,000, I think, to the Department of Parks and Recreation for physical improvements at Montana de Oro State Park. We had been in discussions with them about some, and the county, about some other aspects of what's happening at Montana de Oro affecting public access, and that is that they are coming forward with a permit request to install a gate and kiosk on the road leading into the park so that they can collect fees for park users. That's new. That access to that park has always been free. That will change. And there was some talk about can AT&T contribute to put up at least a year's worth of fees that were projected to be collected to delay the imposition of the fees actually for visitors to the park. We concluded that that was not really a... we didn't see the benefit of doing that long-term because there wouldn't be any long-term benefits. There were some other problems that were raised with it. We had it in the original version of the staff condition. It's still in there as an option, but I just want to make clear that is not what we're going to do. What we're going to do is use the first part of that to make sure that the funds get used for physical improvements to trails, to other public recreational amenities that will provide permanent benefits there. So I just want to make that clear on the record at this point. And Commissioner Ashajian and I have discussed this, and we're in agreement on the use of that money. And then the other mitigation measure is to provide funds to offset potential impacts on hard bottom habitat. And that's going to go to a program that this commission has supported in the past and is a very good program being run out of Davis, UC Davis, to remove derelict fishing gear that continues to entangle other fishing gear that's actually being used and continues to trap marine life. So we think that's a good mitigation offset, and I think the rest of the report is pretty clear in the conditions. So AT&T representatives are here to answer any questions you have. It's my understanding they're in full agreement of the staff recommendation, and I'm not sure that you want to say anything, but you're welcome to, and that completes the staff report.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Douglas. We'll first go to the commissioners for any ex parte communications, starting on my left. Commissioner Ashajian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On February 25th in the 10:30 morning hours, I received a telephone call in my office from Jim Borough and Donna Andrews. We discussed the project, the AT&T's Asia America Gateway project, and they provided me clarifications on any and all potential issues before reaching the Coastal Commission. Mr. Borough's representative for AT&T provided an overview of the project's merits, the environmental review process, and compliance with the California Coastal Act. Mitigation measures include, amongst others, the purchase of carbon offset credit prior to the construction of the project to mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the construction of the project. Other mitigation measures address avoidance of project interactions with marine mammal. And we did also discuss the State Lands Commission, who certified the environmental impact report. Overall, they were supportive of staff's recommendation and complimentary of the hard work. On Friday, prior to last week, I had a meeting with Supervisor Gibson, who represents that district, and our discussion was the same as reported to us today by Executive Director Mr. Douglas, and it's on page 44, you find the condition. It directs the $55,000 to either state parks or the county at the Executive Director's discretion. The uses of this funds, public access and recreation improvements, to postpone for at least 1 year the user fee. And our goal, the county's goal, is that we have the flexibility to do either, and I believe what Mr. Douglas reported this morning is acceptable on behalf of the county, and I appreciate his efforts.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Secord.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had substantially the same conversation through a conference call with Mr. Jim Burrows talking about the project and the marine mammals and the hard substrate issues, the fishing gear and the arrangements with the University of California, Davis.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Potter?
Minor on file.
Thank you. Minor on file. Commissioner Wan? Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Burke?
On Tuesday, Commissioner Curran and myself had a meeting with Donna Andrews and the applicant, and had basically the same conversation with them that was had by Commissioner Asenia.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Wan?
Yes, on Wednesday morning, I had a meeting with Donna Andrews and Jim Burrows. We discussed some very specific concerns of mine with regards to the language about the reporting of any behavioral changes in the wildlife or monitoring of what happens if something happens to the marine mammals. And they showed me a copy of the staff's addendum, and those issues have been resolved through the addendum.
Thank you. Commissioner Mercurimi?
I don't believe they want to talk to me.
Okay. Commissioner Blank?
My ex parte is on file, Madam Chairman.
All right. And no one else? Commissioner Hueso, did you have an ex parte on 5A?
No.
AT&T? Okay, thank you. All right, then we have four speaker slips. I believe Mr. Burrows wants to make remarks, and the others are here to answer questions. How much time would you like, Mr. Burrows? It's right here at the base of the...
Up higher.
Right there, close.
Good?
Yeah.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I am Jim Burrows, representative for AT&T. I just want to say just a very few remarks. This morning, we have Bob Orgo with AT&T with us today, and Chris Berngart, consultant on the project. Chris Kubiak with the Fishermen's Committee is also here today. He's not part of AT&T, but with the Fishermen's Committee. We appreciate very much the hard work that Allison Detmer and Larry Simone have done in bringing this project to you, the meeting today, and we appreciate all the work that the staff have done actually over the last year and a half in working with us on this. I just want to say that the significance of this project, I don't think, is lost on anyone. It's going to be the first direct fiber optic cable link to Southeast Asia, the very first link between the between North America, I believe, and Vietnam. And the partners on this project, the consortium partners, Vietnam, Malaysia, and others, are very interested and very excited to get service on this cable. So we're appreciative of the fact that the staff and the commission have worked with us to bring this here today. But we are here to answer any questions that you may have, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burrows. And we'll bring it back to the staff to see if you have any comments.
No, but, Madam Chair, this is one of those projects that, as you recall, we did make arrangements to expedite the project, given its importance and also the fact that they've helped support the commission's operations, and that's one of the things that we've been that's been required, necessary for us to do under current circumstances, and I'm glad we were able to keep that commitment and bring this matter to you today.
All right, thank you, staff. We have a question from Commissioner Mercurimi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I'm new to this whole docket and the agenda that is before us, so I'm trying to catch up, but through the chair to the staff, can you explain to me why the state park is not here? When I hear of recommendations that in order to help, I think, incentivize this particular project, the idea of establishing a kiosk and imposing a certain fees, perks my ears up. Certainly, I hear of things called to my attention that changes the way that when there was free public access. So how did we get to this place, and then what is the opinion of the state park of the kiosk itself?
Okay, a couple of things. One is the kiosk is not before the commission. That is a development requiring a coastal permit, and it's my understanding that they're going to be filing that with the county in the next, 7 months. And undoubtedly, you will see that on appeal. I can't imagine that that project is not going to be appealed to the commission. And that raises another issue that I'm going to discuss with you in a different context relative to potential changes in the Coastal Act that might expedite situations like this. But that is not before you. What happened was when this came up, we were looking at the issue of impacts from the project itself on public recreational uses. And there's a very short period of time that State Parks is going to have to close a parking lot, parking area, and use of a particular area for the construction and installation of the cable. I think it's less than a week. And we decided that there was a need for an offset there. They have worked and have an agreement with State Parks and there's already a conduit and a kind of utility set up for connections, because there are existing fiber optic cables that run to the landing at the park and then out of the park. So they have an agreement with State Parks relative to the minor impacts. But we felt under the Coastal Act that additional mitigation is appropriate. And in my discussions with Supervisor Gibson and county staff and Commissioner Ashajian, we had thought that it might be a good idea to see how we could defer the imposition of the fee through some sort of contribution from this project. It didn't take long for us to realize that that was not a good idea. We ought to just look for permanent improvements in the park. That's what the funds will be used for. The issue of kiosk and imposition of fees at Montana de Oro will be before you, as I say, at some point in the future. And I'm sure, my guess is sometime next year. And we'll discuss it then, but it really is not connected to this project other than the fact that we had it in there as an alternative use of the funds, which I just indicated we're not going to do at this point.
Next question. As I'm looking through the, and as I was preparing for this particular item, in most of the mitigating, I think, actions taken, whether it's on greenhouse gas emissions or air emissions, how does it extend beyond the completion of the 60-day monitoring period after the cable's been established for ongoing monitoring requirements?
Relative to greenhouse gas emissions?
Relative to greenhouse gas emissions, relative to hard substrate habitat mitigation, relative to NOAA, et cetera.
Well, there are reports required back to the commission relative to the implementation of these conditions, and basically, that's those are kind of standard approaches that right. we have used in other matters. Relative to the reporting back on the cable impact, I mean, we do have to work with, and we'll have a memorandum of understanding with the university for the use of the mitigation funds to remove derelict fishing gear, so we will be able to make sure that the funds get spent for that, and if they don't get spent for that because the program somehow goes away, it can be redirected for, again, a marine life mitigation or beneficial uses. But that program is really a good program. We've supported it before, so I have no reason to believe it's going to go away. Relative to the cable, I think there's a survey and monitoring condition that's in here. I need to confess to you that I'm not the staff person who did this, and to save money, I'm presenting the report. If there are questions that I or Mr. Burroughs can't answer, I can call the office and get answers for you because they're watching this proceeding, and we still have some other items on. But Mr. Burroughs, I think, is in a better position to answer the question of monitoring and reporting back that they're going to be obligated to conduct.
Okay. Mr. Burroughs, could you give your name for the record, please?
Yes, Jim Burroughs for AT&T. Commissioner, with regard to your question, as I remember it, with greenhouse gas, there are greenhouse gas emissions from the cable lay vessel. We are required to mitigate for those emissions by buying carbon offsets. AT&T has already entered into and paid, actually, on a contract for the purchase of those carbon offsets. We've done that within the last 2 weeks, I think. So those carbon offsets will be purchased through a program that has been certified by the CCAR, California Climate Action Registry, California Climate Action Registry. So that's, in effect, being done as we speak. With regard to the NOx emissions, we are required to comply with the San Luis Obispo APCD requirements in that regard, and we will have NOx emissions in exceedance of the CEQA thresholds on the cable lay vessels, and for that we are required to pay a mitigation fee to APCD for mitigation purposes, and that has to be done within 60 days. And I think Mr. Douglas has already explained that with regard to the hard bottom impacts, that money is either paid or will be paid within 60 days through the Coastal Commission for use by UC Davis and the Sea Dock Society. And then, as Mr. Douglas explained, once that money is used by the Sea Dock Society to remove derelict fishing gear, they report per their memorandum of agreement back to the executive director on the success of that program.
Through the chair.
I might also add that if you look at the cable surveying condition, that's condition number 8 on page 6, there are periodic surveys that have to be conducted and periodic reports to the commission executive director, I think it's every 5 years after that. So there is an ongoing monitoring through the surveying of the cable to make sure it stays in place or is not causing damage beyond what had been identified as part of this application and information given to your staff.
Well, I think that goes to the heart of my question. I'm glad you mentioned that, Mr. Douglas, is that I think with the period of time where there is wear and tear on the cable in itself, it's not the initial 6 months to the first 4 years, but it's thereafter when you see any kind of degradation to the instrument itself. And so I was wondering what is built into the MOU that suggests the proper monitoring, adequate monitoring, so that it is the life after when the cable is less new that we're making sure that there are not any adverse effects. That's to the heart of my question.
The condition does require ongoing surveys, and if the videos of the surveys indicate that cable that was supposed to be buried became unburied and somehow resulted in adverse effects that had not been identified and addressed here, then they have to come back within 30 days of the completion of the survey with a plan that gets approved by staff. That's a remediation plan. And that's the commitment. And that's the standard condition we've been putting on other fiber optic cable projects as well. So there is an ongoing monitoring requirement here that's built in.
Is this a standard plan that is then authorized by the state, or is this a standard plan that is best see fit by Coastal Commission staff?
It's one that's that the Coastal Commission crafted many years ago when we first started seeing these fiber optic projects. We've learned from those surveys and from the experience that we have, so we've adapted the condition based on experience that we've had, but that is something that that we have consistently imposed, and those are monitoring requirements both on the applicant and then reviewed by us. And there are some that we've had some issues with, but none with AT&T that I know of. This is not their first project before the commission.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Ashajian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Application number E08021, subject to the conditions set forth in the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Ashajian, a second by Commissioner Secord. The maker and the seconder are recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in conditional approval of the permit and adoption of the resolutions and findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Ashajian?
No, ma'am.
Commissioner Secord?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Do we have any objection to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the commission hereby approves Coastal Development Permit E-08-021 and adopts the findings in the staff report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
One more motion?
We have one more motion.
Oh, okay.
Commissioner Ashajian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the commission concur with consistency certification CC-00509 that the project described therein is consistent with the enforceable policies of the California Coastal Management Program, known as CCMP. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Ashajian, second by Commissioner Secord. They're recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in a concurrence in the certification and adoption of the resolutions and findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Ashajian? Commissioner Secord? Is there any objection to a unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the commission hereby concurs in the consistency certification by AT&T Corporation.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just to express my appreciation to AT&T representatives for working with your staff to resolve issues that were raised in the course of reviewing this and working out the mitigation conditions. So thank you.
All right, thank you.
That takes us to the North Coast, and let me turn it over to Mr. Merrill for the North Coast items. Okay.
As we get started on the North Coast items, I'd just like to mention that there were a few handouts that we distributed last night and in some cases this morning. Those include the pink addendum with the North Coast Deputy Director's Report containing two permit waivers and an immaterial amendment. There's a green addendum that contains one letter each for items 10B and 11A. And then there's a staff addendum for item 13A, the City of Eureka permit amendment for work at the city's Palco Marsh project, which includes letters that have been received and responses to those letters, as well as a minor change to the staff recommendation. If any of the commissioners don't have a packet, I've got extra ones here, so just raise your hand and I can get one to you. The before I discuss the waivers in the district director's report, here's one item that I'd like to report on. Last year, the commission approved two Caltrans projects in Humboldt County, including the Highway 101 Mad River Bridge replacement project and the Highway 101 Alton Interchange project. And both projects will result in the displacement of prime agricultural land of about 40 acres. And the commission was able to approve those projects despite their inconsistency with the Coastal Act Ag conversion policies, because they are essential for providing coastal access, and to deny the projects would have been inconsistent with your public access policies. And so the commission used the conflict resolution policy of the Coastal Act, finding that to approve the projects with appropriate mitigation of the agricultural impacts would be the most protective of coastal resources. For the mitigation, Caltrans had agreed to make a $2 million contribution to the agricultural program of the College of the Redwoods, which is the local junior college in the area. $1.5 million of the money would go to endow an agricultural science professorship in support of the college agricultural curriculum, and the other $500,000 would go directly to infrastructure and transportation improvements. To help students get from the college's campus to the Shively Farm, which is a farm that they had been managing under their program for a number of years as a sustainable organic farm. The farm was in danger of being lost in that it had been willed to the college by someone who said that if it couldn't be used for the ag program, it would be diverted to other uses. And the college was in dire straits in trying to save its agricultural program. So the college felt that the $2 million contribution would be a tremendous boost for the program and would be sufficient to sustain it over time. Since approval of the permits, staff has been working with Caltrans and College of the Redwoods administrators to negotiate the memorandum of understanding that the permits required to be established to implement the mitigation program. The negotiations were somewhat protracted, as the current administrators from the college who were involved were not the same administrators who had enthusiastically supported the proposal when the idea was developed before the commission acted on the permits. And the new administrators had some reservations about the limits in the MOU on the program for use of the farm as a sustainable organic farm, as had been previously agreed to. In the end, the MOU was signed by all parties, but then concern surfaced as to whether this year's state budget crisis would have stopped the money that had been set aside for this mitigation from actually being used for that purpose. But I'm pleased to report that Caltrans was able to deposit the $2 million with the college in early February, and the college is moving forward on hiring the full-time professor that will be funded by the funds and develop improvement plans for spending the money for infrastructure improvements. And the two Caltrans projects are both in their final condition compliance phase and should be fully underway shortly.
Thank you, Bob. That's great news.
The addendum contains three permit waivers and one immaterial permit amendment, and we recommend that the commission concur with the executive director's determinations regarding these items.
All right. Thank you. Any objection to concurrence with the executive director's determination? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
That brings us, there is no consent calendar for North Coast, so we go to item 10A, which is the Humboldt County De Minimis LCP Amendment, HUM-DM-1-9. As submitted by the county, the amendment would amend the county certified zoning regulations to change the procedures for issuing zoning clearances before issuing of building permits, and also to create certain exceptions to base zoning requirements such as yard setbacks and ground coverage to allow for the installation of handicapped accessibility improvements. The first part of the amendment would enable a zoning clearance certificate to be issued in situations when there is an existing violation of the code under the property for certain limited specified conditions, such as if there's been a disaster and there's need to repair damaged portions of the structure, or if the improvements are needed for handicapped accessibility issues, or if the permit is needed to actually cure the violations. Previously, without or currently without the clearances, building permits could not be issued for these projects. The second part would allow for those modifications of the side yard setbacks, ground coverage, building height for handicapped accessibility improvements. We've reviewed the amendment and believe that the amendment qualifies as a de minimis LCP amendment, and we're seeking your concurrence today that it does qualify as a de minimis amendment and should be approved. To qualify, an amendment needs to meet three criteria. The amendment would have should have no impact, either individually or cumulatively, on coastal resources and must be consistent with the policies of the Coastal Act. The local government must provide public notice for a requisite 21-day period, and the amendment can't propose any changes in the use of land or water. With regard to conformance with the last two criteria, the county did provide the sufficient notice, and the amendment would not result in any changes in land use, as it would not change any of the principally or conditionally permitted uses. With regard to impacts of the amendment on coastal resources, it's important to note that these changes would not change any of the other applicable standards of the LCP for protection of coastal resources. For example, environmentally sensitive habitat policies requiring buffers could not be diminished. The project to be approved would still have to comport with all of those different standards designed to protect coastal resources. And so we therefore think that the amendment would not have an impact on coastal resources and is consistent with the Chapter 3 policies of the Coastal Act. The procedure for these de minimis amendments, if three or more commissioners object, then the amendment would be set for a public hearing. If there's not three or more commissioners that object, the amendment would be deemed approved and would become effective within 10 days. So therefore, through the chair, after ex parte communications are disclosed, we'd ask if there are any questions or objections.
All right, let me first check to see if there are any ex parte communications from commissioners. Anything to report? Seeing none, then let me see if there are any objections to concurrence with the executive director's determination.
Question, Madam Chair.
Okay, Commissioner Secord, you had a question.
In the county of Santa Barbara, Bob, the term zoning clearance is like a land use permit, except it does not have a public hearing and is not appealable. Is that the condition here? And secondly, if that is so, couldn't a person get a building permit for a coastal property using a zoning clearance?
The zoning clearance, at least as it's used in Humboldt, I'm not familiar with Santa Barbara, but is more of a in-house approval that the other departments of the county use to be able to provide input to the building department as to whether there are concerns from planning, from the planning department, from public health, from the other agencies that might of the county government that might have a concern. The zoning certificate, zoning clearance certificate, is specifically something that the planning director has to sign off on to say that it meets all the zoning code requirements. And so in that sense, it's an approval, but it isn't really a permit that is subject to a public hearing. But they have to have it before the building inspector is authorized to issue a building permit.
So there is no public hearing with a zoning clearance?
That's right.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Any objection to concurrence with the executive director's determination? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
That brings us to item 10B, which is the Del Norte County LCP Amendment, DNC MAJ 2-8. And Del Norte County is requesting certification of this amendment to the county's implementation program to redesignate the zoning designation of an approximately 10 1/4 acre parcel located in the Surf Sound subdivision, inland of Highway 101, about 1 1/4 miles south of the Oregon border, which is currently zoned with a general resource conservation RCA 1 designation and a rural residential agriculture designation and would be changed to resource conservation area two zoning designations to protect the sensitive habitat on the site and allow the remaining 2.5 or 2 acres of upland adjacent to those resource conservation areas to be designated for the RCA 2 zoning districts. As I mentioned, the green addendum does have one letter. It's a letter from the neighbors that support the amendment, but just indicate that they'd be against any future proposal for further subdivision of the property, which is not actually before you. The staff recommends that the commission, upon completion of the hearing, approve the amendment request as submitted. The amendment is actually a second version of an amendment that the commission considered 4 years ago, where Mr. Brian Walters, the property owner, had proposed very much the same amendment. The commission, in reviewing that earlier amendment, felt that the requisite zones for protection of resource conservation areas weren't sufficiently large and didn't protect enough buffer and wetland habitat area. So the commission denied it as submitted, but certified it with suggested mods that would adjust the size of those resource conservation areas. For various reasons, the county wasn't able to act in a timely manner on those suggested modifications, and the amendment expired. And so this is essentially a reapplication for that amendment. However, in this instance, the property owner has gone back and remapped the zones, and they conform with the suggested modifications that the commission imposed several years ago. And so therefore, we believe that, with those resource conservation areas being broadened to incorporate all of the area that the commission previously felt should be protected, that the amendment does conform with the certified land use plan, and we're recommending that the commission find that the amendment is adequate to carry out the land use plan and recommend approval. And the motion to adopt the staff recommendation is found on page 3.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Let me first look to my left to see if there are any ex parte communications on this item. Okay, any on the right? Seeing none, then we have no speakers, so I'll bring it back to the commission for deliberation. Get your mic on. Commissioner Shajian.
I move that the commission reject implementation program amendment number DNC-MAJ-208 for the County of Del Norte as submitted. Recommend a no vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Shajian, a second by Commissioner Secord. The maker and the seconder are recommending a no vote. Passage of the motion will result in certification of the implementation program amendment as submitted and adoption of the findings and resolutions in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No, ma'am.
Commissioner Secord?
No, ma'am.
All right. Is there any objection to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the commission hereby certifies the implementation program amendment number DNC-MAJ-2-08 for the County of Del Norte as submitted. Thank you, staff.
Item 11A is a new appeal that was filed by Mr. Gordon Moores from a decision of Mendocino County to grant a permit with conditions to his brother, William Moores, for the installation of an extension of a culvert to capture the flow within a 24-foot-long section of a water course and fill over the culverted area and grade it in, to provide more parking for the real estate office that's on the property. The project site's located within the Irish Beach subdivision along the southern Mendocino County coast at 44001 Noyo Way. The green addendum does contain one letter. The letter's from the Irish Beach Architectural Design Committee informing the commission that the applicant has failed to obtain a necessary approval from the subdivision's design committee pursuant to its CC&Rs. Staff is recommending that the commission determine that the appeal raises a substantial issue of conformance with the certified LCP. The three contentions raised by the appellant are that filling a wetland to provide safe parking for vehicles is not an allowable fill purpose under the LCP, that feasible alternatives to filling the wetland exist to serve the parking needs and protect the vehicles from driving into the water course without the fill, and there's a lack of an adequate buffer between the fill and a environmentally sensitive riparian and Point Arena Mountain beaver habitat that's located 20 feet away. And staff believes that all three of these contentions raise substantial issues. The LCP is similar to the Coastal Act in limiting fill for certain uses, and parking for real estate offices is certainly not one of them. There is no discussion in the staff report about feasible alternatives, so there's a substantial issue of whether it's even needed if it were an allowable use. And the LCP has a minimum buffer width policy that says any development must be at least 50 feet from adjoining sensitive habitat. And there's no explanation in the staff report as to how a 20-foot buffer meets that requirement. So unless three or more commissioners wish to hear more about this, the substantial issue question, the appeal would be presumed to raise a substantial issue, and the commission would consider the de novo portion at a future meeting. If three or more commissioners do wish to hear more about it, then I will present a more detailed presentation.
All right. Thank you, staff. First, let me ask if there are any ex parte communications through commissioners on my left and on the right. Seeing none. I have no speaker slips on this item, so I'll just ask the commission, do our three or more commissioners wish to discuss the issue of substantial issue? Seeing none, substantial issue has been found, and then we'll go ahead and set the de novo hearing in the future.
Correct.
Thank you. Item 12 is the postponed item, Pacific Gas and Electric, so that brings us to item 13A, which is the permit amendment application of the City of Eureka. And this amendment involves modification of a permit granted by the Commission in 1990 to the City of Eureka for the Palco Marsh enhancement project, which involves various improvements to fresh salt and brackish water marshes and installation of public access improvements within a roughly 86-acre area along the margin of Humboldt Bay in Eureka between the Bayshore Mall and Del Norte Street. The current amendment seeks authorization for modifying culvert and drainage control structures to further enhance tidal exchange between the Palco Marsh and the Bay. The amendment also includes, and to do that, it includes replacing a collapsing 24-inch culvert connecting the marsh with the bay with a 48-inch culvert, modifying a separate drainage structure near Del Norte Street, installing two other 12-inch diameter culverts internally within the marsh, excavating the tidal channel adjacent to the marsh that feeds water into the marsh, and hand excavating 100 feet of channel within the marsh proper to improve water circulation, and as well as performing exotic invasive plant eradication and replanting native species, installing riparian buffers along the edges of the marsh, and instituting a monitoring program to ensure that the objectives of the restoration project succeed. There is a staff handout, as I mentioned, that presents correspondence received from the applicant, from Humboldt Baykeeper, who raises concerns about suggesting there's a need for further sampling, letters from the Redwood Audubon Society and the Sierra Club, which urge that the commission move forward and approve the project without further sampling. And then the addendum makes responses to those comments and makes a minor adjustment in one of the conditions to allow for the preparation and review of an erosion control plan in phases rather than all at once. The staff is recommending that the commission approve the permit amendment request with the conditions listed in the staff report and as modified by the addendum. The project site has long been recognized as an area of special importance because of its historical habitat values, but over the last 150 years, it's been severely degraded by the diking and partial filling for a lumber mill and other uses, and the marsh habitat values had become extremely degraded. Throughout the early 80s, the commission included Palco Marsh on its list to the legislature of priority public acquisitions, and the commission has supported the city's application over the years for funds from the Conservancy and other organizations to acquire and enhance the site. Upon certification of the LCP in 1984, policies were formally adopted identifying Palco Marsh for protection of its existing and potential natural resource values. The Coastal Conservancy has granted over $1.5 million for various planning and implementation measures for implementation of the project. And the phase one of the project was performed in large measure. There were parts of the phase one that were delayed. The project has been plagued by a number of things that have slowed progress, including an underground leak of hydrocarbons from a nearby gas station. There's also been problems with getting necessary permissions from the railroad for putting in certain improvements and other aspects that have slowed the progress. But many of the improvements were completed, and after completion, the city evaluated what had been done and realized that there was a need to make some changes, that there hasn't primarily been sufficient water coming into the marsh to provide for the enhancement of salt marsh vegetation and other habitat that had been envisioned. And so under the current amendment, the project does include these various improvements that I mentioned that are in large part geared towards improving water circulation and tidal exchange. We believe that the overall project proposed in the permit amendment is consistent with the limitations in Section 30233 of the Coastal Act on the diking and filling and dredging of wetlands, as the project is clearly for restoration purposes, which, if successful, will have great benefits for wildlife habitat. The amendment will help ensure that the habitat benefits first envisioned years ago when this whole process started will hopefully be finally realized. The principal issue that has come up in the review of the project has been whether the proposed excavation of 1,000 feet of tidal channel that feeds tidewaters to the marsh and the adjacent to the marsh and to other areas upstream, and also the proposed hand excavation of the 100-foot-long channel within the marsh will cause the release and dispersal of sediments contaminated with dioxins and furans. As part of an unrelated investigation regarding the release and spread of pentachlorophenol wood preservatives in a stormwater runoff from a nearby former plywood mill, relatively elevated levels of dioxin were discovered in sediment samples located within the tidal channel that's proposed to be excavated, situated downgradient from the former mill site and adjacent but not within the Palco Marsh itself. The discovery of the tidal slough contaminants and the receipt of an earlier letter by the city from Humboldt Baykeeper that suggested that the dioxin may have migrated into Palco Marsh from inflows through the drainage facilities raised concerns about whether dioxin contamination might be present in other portions of the project and whether the project excavation work would result in further releases of those contaminated sediments to the detriment of the ecology and human health. These concerns prompted additional sampling to be undertaken, and in the year and a half since this issue came to light, our water quality staff and Dr. Gregg, who's sitting beside me, has been involved in reviewing the whole issue and has reviewed those sediment samples and has evaluated whether this raises a concern for the work proposed within the marsh. The samples that were taken generally reflect that the samples within the marsh are at large are generally at background dioxin levels for Humboldt Bay. For various reasons that Jack will get into during his presentation, we believe that the likelihood that the contaminants from the mill of having entered the marsh is very low. And on that basis, we believe the proposed excavation of the 100-foot-long channel within the marsh and the fact that the excavation of the 1,000 feet of channel of the tidal channel will be done as if the material is contaminated and handled as contaminated waste and properly disposed of, that with those measures and the low probability of contaminants in the marsh, that the project will be protective of human health and will help restore the quality of coastal waters and maintain optimum populations of marine organisms consistent with Section 30231 of the Coastal Act. Now, since publication of the staff report, the Commission has received this additional letter from Humboldt Baykeeper suggesting that additional sampling should be performed within the marsh to ensure that the excavation work will not disperse and disturb the contaminated sediments. As Jack will discuss, the Palco Marsh is close to the contamination areas discovered around the Simpson Mill site, but we don't believe that it's likely the contaminants have made their way into the marsh, and there is not sufficient evidence of potential problems to, in our opinion, warrant additional sampling. The Regional Water Quality Control Board staff has submitted a letter that's in your packet that agrees that further sampling is not warranted. we're generally concerned that if there is no evidence that suggests that it is warranted, that the additional expense that will be involved in doing the testing may lead to compromises in the restoration activities and reduce the overall effectiveness of the Palco Marsh restoration plan. Before I turn the mic over to Dr. Gregg, I will note that the addendum does contain a change to recommended special condition number 7, which, as I noted, affects the erosion control plan condition to allow the plans for the different phases of the project to be submitted and reviewed in phases rather than all at once. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to Dr. Gregg.
Welcome, Dr. Gregg.
Thank you. And I have a PowerPoint presentation we'll bring up. I'm Jack Gregg, the supervisor of the Water Quality Unit for the California Coastal Commission. And I have been looking at this data for about a year and a half. There is a lot of data in Humboldt Bay related to dioxin. Of course, it was a former center of timber processing, so there were a lot of mills around the bay. Many of them used pentachlorophenol, which has dioxin as a contaminant that has been released in different parts of the bay, and also burning of timber and other materials did release dioxin into the air, which deposited around the bay. This is a general overview of Palco Marsh. This is going to be tricky. Oops. See if I can do this with my left hand here, so I won't drill through Hope's head. Okay. Oh, I'm getting the. What's the trigger down below?
We can't see
that. Right. Okay. Last slide, please. Okay. All right, next slide, please. Maybe I'll just wave my hands. The major green area here is the Palco Marsh, and oh, thanks, Bob. And we're going to be focusing a lot of attention on the northwest corner of the marsh up here. I wanted to point out that the tidal channel, the 1,000 foot of tidal channel that Bob was describing, I think this is. Can you show me how to use this? Well, I did need to point out a couple things on this one, but I'll wave my hands.
How about this?
No, you can't.
Okay. The tidal channel goes along the former railroad tracks. Can you point out the tidal channel? Right, and drains not only Simpson plywood mill up above, and then drains down to the bay. Oh, thank you.
Push the button on the end there.
Okay. All right. All right. Oh, okay. Here's the tidal channel. Here is where it's draining to the bay. This is Del Norte Street. We'll be using that as a reference as well. And I think those were. Okay. Next slide, please. This is in your packet, and the main thing I wanted to show, this is now, north is pointing to the left of the screen. This is the northwest corner of Palco Marsh. These are the channels that were dug at one point to drain the marsh, and the 100-foot channel that's going to be hand-dug will be off into this area to drain a pond that is now sits stagnant in that part of the marsh. Next slide, please. So the question is, why would we do we need additional sampling here to evaluate what's the risk to human health in the environment? What would be the purpose of additional sampling? One reason that we would like additional sampling at times is to delineate a known source. If you know where it is, you need to better define what the boundaries are so you can deal with that source. You can also use additional sampling to explore for unknown sources if you have some reasonable belief that there is a source of contamination in the area you're exploring. And you can use additional sampling to estimate ecological and human health risk. Next slide. next slide. Okay, and so we're going to look at first at the site's land use history. The site, here I did it. There we go. The site was, once it had been levied off from the bay, it was used for pasture land for a long period of time. This is a slide from 1964, and it will go to the next slide. So, thank you. All right, back up one. Please. And this is a detail from that 1964 slide. It shows in the northwest corner of the marsh, there was in 64, there was a barn, there was a rail car that had been overturned, and there was probably a lot of farming debris in that area. They also had cleared this area and perhaps brought in fill so they could operate there. In 1955, there was three culverts put under the railroad tracks to connect this tidal channel to the city storm drains that drain in from the city in this area. There's a junction box we'll be talking a little bit more right next to the barn. They actually also built a small pipe going off in this direction, but they plugged it, and we understand that that was for future development potential of the marsh. This slide is from 1991, and it's showing the barn has been removed, and there's been some additional work done in the northwest corner of the marsh. This detail is showing some of the area that apparently had been scraped, and this was after the beginning of the restoration of the first phase of restoration, and trash such as the railroad car and other debris was removed from there. You can actually see the beginnings of that drainage ditch that was dug at one time to drain this area. Of course, the new drainage ditch is going to be going off this way. Next, we'll look at the distribution of dioxin in Humboldt Bay. As I said, there is quite a bit of there is dioxins throughout the bay from former land use practices. This shows some of the data that was gathered during the an investigation of a spill in the Mad River in the north end of the bay. In this area, there was a spill of large amounts of PCP and dioxin. What I'm showing here is part of the risk assessment that went along with that. There were a number of samples taken in the North Bay, and you can see that there are residual levels of dioxin throughout the North Bay. And next, we're going to go down to the Eureka waterfront for a little more detail. And again, you're seeing levels on these are in nanograms per kilogram, parts per trillion, and these are levels that are approaching levels of screening levels by the U.S. EPA to see levels that where they'd be concerned about potential impacts to aquatic organisms. And then the 15.6 to the left there is related to a storm drain and probably related to runoff from another mill site. And I say that those levels are near screening levels that the U.S. EPA would use, but these are levels that are found throughout the bay. And just because it exceeds a screening level doesn't mean it's necessarily impacting aquatic organisms. It means that the EPA would want to take a closer look at that. This is just a transition slide to show where we just were on the Eureka waterfront, moving down to Palco Marsh down here. And I just wanted to focus in on this was the Simpson plywood mill. They did spill materials in this drainage ditch that connects with the tidal channel after going under Del Norte Street. And this is some of their data that they submitted in their remedial action plan. I took that data and put it onto this map showing that in the ditch it was at 4 nanograms per kilogram at the north end of the ditch. 2,000, 89,000, 23,000, 26. And then their last sample, just before the ditch goes under Del Norte Road, was 59 nanograms per kilogram. This sample was taken by Baykeeper and shows 46. And then this sample was taken by Casey Ashley of the Regional Water Quality Control Board with Baykeeper in attendance, showing that by the time you get out to the bay, the levels have decreased markedly. I think I'll use this slide also to I'll have another slide to show, but there's been a claim that Palco is downstream from this area, and that's not really true. Both Simpson drains into this tidal ditch, and Palco drains into the tidal ditch there and also down here. But Palco is not directly downstream from the Simpson mill. These are some of the screening levels that Baykeeper listed in their comment letter, plus one that I added. The 0.85 nanograms per kilogram is a level that the Regional Water Board used to determine if they were going to list the whole bay. They wanted to see what are the levels in the whole bay. This is a modeled number that if this level was present everywhere in the bay, it could, through bioaccumulation, get to a level where fish in the bay would not be safe for eating. And that's how they determined that they were going to list the whole bay for dioxin. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will cause an impact, but that's a screening level that they use to make a determination whether to list the waters. The next level is a screening level NOAA uses to begin being concerned about aquatic life impacts. And the last one is EPA's Region 9 screening level to determine what is a level in residential soil that could cause a potential cancer impact at to children or anybody playing in residential soil. So if the levels are below this in residential soil, they generally won't do additional work. But if they're above that, then they go to the next step and take more samples. And keep in mind, that is for residential soil. Next, we'll look at the hydraulic conditions. This picture is basically showing the northwest corner of the Palco Marsh again. This is showing where the three culverts connect. Well, basically the city storm drain comes down here, goes into a junction box, and then drains through these three culverts into the tidal channel. As I said, there's a small pipe here that was available for additional drainage of Palco Marsh. At some point, initially it was plugged. At some point, I'm not sure who it was, came in and took out the plug and put in a tidal, a tide gate. And tide gates were present on both the city storm drain and on this small pipe. And those are used to allow water to drain out but keep the tide from going back up into the storm drain system. And late last night, I figured I should draw this a little better because it is important. This is what the shape of that junction box is. Most of the water is coming in here and going this way to the tidal channel. This is the small stubbed pipe. By the time City of Eureka staff were out there looking at it, there were tide gates both here and there to keep water from going back upstream. And at the time they were doing the restoration in 1991, they wanted tidal water to go back up into the marsh, so they tied that gate open to allow tidal water to go up into the marsh. Keep in mind, this was way after PCB and dioxin had been, was part of, those were no longer being used by the industry, and it's not expected that at that time there was a lot of movement of sediment. You could see from the earlier picture I showed that sediment going downstream from the Simpson plywood mill, not much of the dioxin made it down to Del Norte Street, and if there was any sediment going back upstream from here, it would have been only after 1991 and would have been relatively low levels of dioxin. This is where the junction box, those three pipes connect into the tidal channel, and it's very well clogged at this point, so not much water gets up that way. This is part of the project, is to clean this up, clean up the junction box, and restore tidal circulation, much better tidal circulation into the marsh. And so the conclusions are, based on the land use, there's no reason to believe that there's a source of any kind of industrial activities that would have had a source of dioxin in the marsh. The evidence suggests, both on hydraulic basis and distribution of dioxin and former land use, that there's it doesn't appear that there would have been dioxin of any significant levels moving into the marsh. And if there are low levels of dioxin in the marsh from air deposition or stormwater, they're going to be, there's no reason to expect that they would be any greater than other sources of dioxin around the bay, and that they would cause an additional adverse impact to the bay. So it certainly is, as a scientist, it's always better to have more data, and it helps you go further with your interpretations, but you have to use the data that you have to decide whether it's worth gathering that additional data. And based on what I've seen, I don't see a reason for additional sampling in the marsh. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Gregg. Did you have anything else, Bob?
thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to conclude that we recommend that you adopt the staff recommendation as modified by the addendum, and the motion is found on page 7 of the staff report.
Okay, thank you. We have two speakers on this item, and let me start on my left to see if there are any ex parte communications from commissioners. Mine are on file. Anyone on the right? No? Then we'll go ahead and open the public hearing and call on Lisa Chicaney from the City of Eureka. And you can have up to 15 minutes, Ms. Chicaney, but just let us know how much time you need, and we'll save some for rebuttal.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you. I am Lisa Chicaney. I have the privilege of working as the environmental planner for the City of Eureka. I just have a couple of minutes of comments.
Okay. Thank you.
I am here just to let you know that we are very pleased to have this project before the commission. I've been working towards this for about 6-7 years now since I've worked for the city. Numerous delays. We are in concurrence with staff's recommendation. We have been working now, as Jack said, for a year and a half to address the commission and Baykeepers' concerns, and we believe that we have done so. So I'm really here to answer any questions that you may have. I think that the staff report covered the issues. Clearly, we are not, I would like to add, anything that we are doing the work that we are doing is not going to increase sediment transport in or out of the bay, and I think that is one of the key considerations. So I'm happy to answer any questions now or later if you have any.
All right, well, we'll see if the commission has questions later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joel Gerwin? 3 minutes.
Hello, I'm Joel Gerwine from the Coastal Conservancy. I'm the latest in a long series of project managers on this project that's gone on for a long time, since our initial grant for the enhancement of Palco Marsh about 20 years ago now. I'm also just here to thank the commission staff for their hard work on this project, and to say that the Conservancy also feels that, while of course we don't want this project to cause any harm, that's not what we're in the business of doing, we do agree that there is not a reasonable basis to be concerned about contamination from the project, both because the marsh itself doesn't, there's a strong reason to suspect that it's contaminated with dioxin, and also because there's not expected to be any significant sediment transport out of the marsh as a result of this enhancement project. So from our perspective, we're looking at a real benefit to wildlife and to habitat, and we're not looking at any downside in terms of ecological harm. So I'm just here to, on behalf of the Coastal Conservancy, to support the staff's recommendation that the project go forward without additional testing and the delays that would entail. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let me bring it back to staff. Any comments?
No comment, Madam Chair.
All right, then bring it back to the commission. Commissioner Juan, you had a question?
Yes. I understand the desire to move forward with the restoration project, but I do still have some concerns about the testing issue, and I will read from the staff addendum something that concerns me, and from the Water Quality Control Board's letter in response to concerns raised by the Baykeeper. It says, while acknowledging the theoretical possibility of such entry of contaminated sediment materials, water quality staff state they're not aware of any specific information on the movement of sediment from the tidal slough into Palco Marsh. But then if you go to the Regional Water Quality Control Board's letter, it says, and this is as of March 9th, staff is not aware of any specific information on the movement of sediments from the Simpson site into the marsh. To our knowledge, sediment transportation rates and possible areas of deposition have not been studied. So I find that a little troubling, because we're making these assumptions that you don't need to do this because you don't have any specific information, but you don't have any specific information because you haven't studied it. So that kind of concerns me. I'm looking at those two statements in conjunction with each other, and then I go to the Baykeeper letter, in which all they're asking for is essentially three additional sediment testings. So they want, it says, three sediment samples is what they're asking for. And while I realize you don't do sediment testing just for the sake of testing, if in fact there is a concern, and there are dioxins throughout this area and at one level or another, to say, well, theoretically, we don't think it'll be there, and not to do any the sampling to tell whether or not you've got sediment, and it's a sediment transport issue, I understand, it doesn't make scientific sense to me, frankly. You don't have any data. This isn't extra data. Apparently, according to Water Quality Control Board, the data isn't there.
Madam Chair, we have looked at this question closely because we, too, are concerned. And the problem is that all the information we do have does not suggest that there's a dioxin problem. And to do these tests, they're expensive. And it's our understanding if the city is required to do these additional tests, they simply won't do this part of the project. And this part of the project is really important to restore the kind of tidal action and flushing that we think is necessary. So to do unnecessary tests at the expense of a vital part of the project, we just thought wasn't justified, and that's why we're not recommending it.
Well, you see what my concern is here as to whether it's unnecessary. If I don't have any data, and if they say they haven't studied it, then my question becomes, and I understand the quandary you're in, right, particularly about funding, but if you haven't done it,
We've looked at all the available data, right, and as Dr. Gregg indicates, he and the Water Quality Control Board have looked at the available data and the topography and other circumstances of this situation, and just don't see a level of concern that would warrant the imposition of the requirement.
Perhaps Mr. Gregg could answer. You understand what I'm saying here, because I'm reading what the Water Quality Control Board tells me.
Yes, I do. And I think what Ms. Ashley was saying, she's a senior engineering geologist there. She was responsible for taking samples throughout the bay, and really I looked to her for on-the-ground recommendations on, you know, whether she thought additional sampling was necessary. And I think what she's saying there, I know what she's saying there, is that there's been no specific study of how much sediment could move from the tidal channel into the marsh. But the lines of evidence that we do have are the land use, the distribution of dioxin that we do have, and the what we know about the hydrology. And the other thing about the hydrology that makes it even more hard to believe that, you know, I can imagine some amount of sediment got into the marsh, but not very much. That sediment would have to come into the tidal channel, be backed up by a high tide that would keep it from going. If there wasn't a high tide, the water would go straight out to the bay, down a little teeny ditch out to the bay. So it would have to be high tide. It then has to go up through those three 36-inch corrugated metal pipes, a couple hundred feet at least, maybe 300 feet, before it gets into that junction box. And then it has to go past the tidal, the tide gate, and uphill into Palco Marsh. So the amount of sediment that got there was very little, if any. As a scientist, I'd say some got there, but it's very little. I don't think it's a significant source to Palco Marsh. I really can't, do not think that Palco Marsh will be a significant source back into the bay.
Okay. Commissioner Schallenberger.
I move the commission approve Coastal Development Permit Amendment Number 1-90-104-A2 pursuant to staff recommendation in the as amended today.
Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner Schallenberger and a second by Commissioner Secord. The maker and seconder are recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in approval of the permit amendment as condition and adoption of the findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a really important marsh. It has, as outlined in our staff report, its historic value, its resource value, and it's certainly, I mean, I think it's exciting moving forward on the restoration. And as a scientist by education, I share the desire to have more information and to continue to do studies. On the other hand, I'm convinced by both our own staff report and the presentation today of Dr. Gregg, as well as the Water Board's letter, that between the two, we could, of course, do more studies and get more information, but it doesn't seem to be a cost-effective thing to do at this point. Dioxin is an issue. I don't want to say a problem, but we know it's an issue all around that area because of the historic uses of the timber industry. But I can't find anything that on the information that's before us that would lead me to believe that we need to be of additional concern, have additional concern on this particular project. So for that, I would urge my commissioners to support the project and let it move forward.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Mercurimi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I am processing all the information, I wasn't sure, other than the fact that we don't want to delay this project, and I get that, but I'm wondering that if additional sampling, which I understand is cost prohibitive, why that couldn't be provisional and that the project still moves forward with the procedure of collecting either one of the three samples as the advocates had suggested, and then based on the outcome of that sampling would then, I think, remark or instruct how the project would then proceed. But why delay the project at all and then still be able to conduct the sample to help satisfy outstanding concerns?
Our understanding is that because of the cost of sampling and testing the material, and there's no sense in just getting samples if you don't find out what's in them, is of such a magnitude that they're just going to drop out that segment of the project. And that's the problem. And we didn't see a basis for asking for it, and we think that this segment of the project really is important to the viability of the overall restoration effort here. And dropping it out, we think, would really not be a good thing for the project. So that's how we got into this. We can't do what you're suggesting and still have this portion of the project, is my understanding.
All right. Commissioner Wan?
Yeah, one additional question. Can the baykeeper be allowed to do it on their own if they come up with the funds?
I don't see why not.
I think one of the things that makes taking additional samples there difficult is that you really need to define what are we trying to answer here, and how do we take a sample that fairly evaluates the risk. If it came to us to have to do this sampling, I'd say additional coring needs to be done there to see if there's fill material from the past uses, to see what the distribution of bay muds are out there, and to try to evaluate where sediment would have gone. And it would be quite a process to decide where could you take fair samples to answer the question. I don't, even though the samples are $1,000 a piece, I think you're talking a $10,000 project. And then when you have the data, you have to know what you're going to do with it. And it, clearly if it's really high, then we're all wrong and something, you have to go down a different path. But I think you'll find that the data will look like background data from the bay, and we won't really know much more than we do now.
If they get that answer that it's the background, if it's the background data from the bay, then that answers the question that says that there isn't a basis for it. And if you do get something that says that
that it's elevated, then it may require that you take another look at it. And it would seem to me that the basis for not requiring this is the funding. So if the baykeeper, it would also seem to me that if the baykeeper wishes to do this in conjunction, obviously not on their own, with our staff and water quality staff, and they want to pay for it, I don't know why we should prohibit that. And I think that would, however, need, but that would need to be part of the condition, because otherwise they could, this is private property.
Well, you're not, we're not prohibiting it here. What you're suggesting then is that if the baykeeper wants to do testing, that they should not be precluded from doing that testing.
That's right.
And I'd have to ask the applicant whether or not they have any objection to that. And then what you're suggesting beyond that is that if they submit that information to your staff and the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and our staff and the regional board agree that if the information shows higher levels of contamination than we had anticipated, and we agree that that's valid, that we would then have the ability to require changes in the project.
Yeah, in essence, that's what I'm saying.
I don't see that that would be a problem from my perspective. I think the city...
Can we have the city representative come up, Ms. Chicaney?
As long as it doesn't slow up the project.
Could you give your name for the record? Thank you.
Yes. I'm Lisa Chicaney, environmental planner, City of Eureka. I think what we need to look at here is the only work that's being proposed in that area of the marsh is a hand-dug channel, 1 foot deep and 2 feet wide, 100 feet long or less. We are proposing to handle the spoils that we take out of the tidal channel dredging, the culverts, the junction box, and the hand-dug channel as though they may contain dioxin, because we know that at the very top of the tidal channel there was a relatively low level of dioxin as compared to Simpson's drainage ditch up north, so that it suggests very little contamination is coming south from Simpson's site. So What would testing do? Testing would first of all tell us what to do with the contaminated soil. We're handling it as contaminated. Workers will be protected. It will be taken to an appropriate location. Secondly, we would be removing, if any sediment had come in through that through the three culverts, we're actually going to be removing it. We're removing the top 12 inches of soil in that area. So even if anything had come through, we would be removing it. And thirdly, we are not creating sediment transport that would move significant amounts of sediment out of the marsh. So that in and of itself would not, there's no nexus between what we're doing and the need for more testing. As far as having baykeeper come in and test on our property, could there be dioxin? What if there was dioxin 2 feet down? Are we doing anything to create any additional transport of that outside of the marsh? No, we are not. That starts speaking to liabilities I think I can't really speak to. But at this point, with there being no nexus between our project and the need for more testing and the impacts between what we are doing and the risks to the bay, I think that that's a real issue here for the city as well as the commission to consider.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Chicaney. Commissioner Schallenberger.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the representative from the city I have a specific question. If the commission decided that what they wanted to do is amend this so that the baykeeper was not prohibited from doing testing in the marsh pursuant to our own staff and the water board's agreement on how the testing was being conducted and what it was for and what they were looking for. And that the results would go to you and to our staff. they would be paying for it. Would you object to that? I mean, I don't want them. It wouldn't be just testing wherever they wanted and for whatever they wanted and however they wanted, but along the lines of what our executive director outlined in terms of.
Well,
I'm looking for kind of a simple answer here and not a logic of why you're going to answer it.
I'm not fully comfortable with the testing in that the liabilities for could there be more testing and could there be more testing required after that, when if there's no nexus to what the city is doing, then does that put the city potentially... If it was information gathering,
I think your answer is no.
I'm not fully comfortable with it. But if it's a condition that you choose to put on the project, as was explained, then the city is going to reserve the right to move forward with that element of the project. It was not part of the original enhancement plan. The ditch was something that we
thank
thought
you
would be good.
Very much.
So.
Madam Chair.
Can I just follow up? As the maker of the motion, I am... As I said when I spoke to my motion, I don't think this is a major issue. I am comfortable with our staff recommendation. I'm comfortable with the report we had, with what the Water Board says. So I, as the maker of the motion, will not be supporting any amendment to this motion. All right.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I think the point here is that the 1 foot hand-dug clearing of the channel, all that material is going to be treated as though it were contaminated, even though we don't think it is. So it'll be disposed of in a proper way. So that's another reason that we just don't see a basis for it. And I can understand the city's concern about liability if the testing goes deeper or finds other areas where there might be contaminants. So relative to the connection with this project, I tend to agree. I don't think that we really need any additional testing.
All right.
Here.
Thank you. We have one other commissioner that wishes to address this issue. Commissioner Clark?
Just to say that I totally agree with where Commissioner Schallenberger came down in terms of, as maker of the motion, not adding this or supporting it as an amendment.
All right. Thank you. We have a motion by Commissioner Schallenberger, a second by Commissioner Secord. The maker and seconder are recommending a yes vote. And since this isn't in my area, I just wanted to say that I do really appreciate the work that Baykeeper does in Humboldt County. They do a great job in trying to protect our bay and our water. In this case, I do agree with our staff, however, that they've done the appropriate analysis, and I'm going to be supporting the motion. So maybe we should have a roll call vote on this. Is there any objection to a unanimous roll call vote on this? Seeing none, the commission unanimously approves this item, approves the proposed permit amendment, and adopts the findings in the staff report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, I think you have a public comment, and then after that, we'll need to go into a brief closed session. And I would ask members of the public after the public comments to please leave
the
room.
All right, we're going to thank the City of Eureka for being here as well. We're going to go to public comment time now, and we have 4 speakers. We're going to give 3 minutes to each speaker, and the first is Angus Jeffers. Could you turn your mic on, please? It's right here at the base. It's up here on the pole part, right here, up here. That's it.
There we go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Angus Jeffers. I'm here with my experience as a land use attorney. Given the condition of our state budget and the quantity of work tackled by the commission and coastal staff, I'd like to make a suggestion that the commission encourage a process for coastal staff to accept invitations to join applicants for on-site pre-application site visits. This is something which I always encourage my clients to, an invitation I always encourage them to make. Usually they're hesitant to make such an invitation for an on-site pre-application site visit, along with all the other regulators who may be involved in reviewing a development project. But when I let them know that coastal staff, you know, often will flag for appeal projects, which they haven't yet had the time to come on site and confirm that that project can address site constraints, that they will flag that for an appeal. Secondly, they're often convinced when I let them know that, look, would you rather know of a project's or coastal staff's thoughts and concerns at the outset of a project before you're fully committed, or after you've gone through a protracted and rigorous local review process and find that you're back at square one? Unfortunately, over the last 4 or 5 years, coastal staff hasn't been able to accept these invitations for on-site pre-application site visits. They always express that they like the idea and they'd like to be able to join everybody else, but that their staffing constraints don't allow them the time to do that. Often it's because of the quantity of time required to process a formal appeal. While I think that these pre-application site visits might limit the need or the quantity of those formal appeals, because applicants would have that opportunity to design their projects, incorporating the thoughts and concerns of coastal staff at the outset, rather than after the local appeal process, and that coastal staff would receive these projects after the local approval with ground-based knowledge that, yeah, that project could actually address viewshed, slope, access, and all the other site constraints. Anyways, that's my suggestion. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And I believe Commissioner Blank had a comment.
Sure. Through the chair, Director Douglas, can you just comment on do we do that, or what is the policy, or is it?
Well, my first off comment is that the speaker was absolutely right. We would prefer to do that, and there was a time when we could do it, but with budget cuts, staffing reductions, we're not able to do that anymore, and that's very unfortunate. And that's one of the consequences of staff reductions and budget cuts that we've pointed out over the years, and it does put us in a and. The property owners and the applicants in a very frustrating and difficult position. We'd like to do it, but we can't do it in every case where we're asked. We do it on occasion, and one of the things that we have found too is that because of the constraints, when we do have an appeal and we raise some issues and the applicant is able to make changes in the project and incorporate those into the project, that we have with some regularity then recommended dropping the appeal. But that isn't at the front end, and we'd love to do it, but we just don't have the resources to do it.
So can I just maybe make an observation or question or comment? I'm not sure which yet. We've now in the last year or two have had applicants for major projects actually pay for additional staff resources. And I was just wondering, why wouldn't we use this as an opportunity to also mitigate any cost and, in fact, maybe add on to our staff resources by making it an option for applicants who want a pre-staff report visit? I mean, there's now a precedent for us actually asking for budget help in this, and I think it might actually, in the end, reduce staff time and certainly commissioner's time in this. And have you considered that?
Yes, we have, and as we've explained on numerous occasions to this commission, the cost augmentations, for example, on the AT&T, that wasn't for additional staff. That was to help augment the commission's overall budget costs so that we would avoid losing additional staff. The other aspect of that was that was moving that item up in the queue from where it would have been ahead of others. It did not provide us with additional staff resources, and there is no way that we can accomplish what's being suggested, because you can't just bring in a new staff person. Besides, I mean, we wouldn't be able to do it, but the reality is you can't bring in a new staff person to do a site visit without the experience necessary to know whether or not there are issues raised by the particular project. So for a variety of reasons, that approach just isn't going to work, unfortunately.
Thank you, Director Douglas.
All right, thank you. The next speaker is Nancy Pratt.
I might note before she comes up, we do take occasions like yesterday. We finished a little early, and your staff did do a number of site visits, and we've answered some questions about whether a future appeal is necessary on a couple of those just because we were here. So we try to do that, multitasking while we're at it.
Okay. We have 3 minutes, ma'am.
Nancy Pratt, Carmel Valley. Good morning, commissioners. I'm here to discuss the issue of financial conflict of interests. Last time the commissioners met in Monterey, the meeting was held at Rancho Cañada, and this is a definite conflict of interest because Rancho Cañada is owned by Tony Lombardo, a land use attorney, and Tony Lombardo was the lawyer representing a project that was on that commission agenda. So having your meeting at the location, a property owned by one of the representatives of an applicant, I find extremely bad in terms of financial conflict of interest. The commission or the legislature must adopt rules to stop meeting at locations with projects on the agenda and to stop commissioners from influencing meeting locations to keep it nice and clean and no potential conflict of interest. And thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, if
yes.
I may comment on that. We were made aware of that situation shortly before the meeting, and as you know, that was a year ago today, this month, when the Commission adopted its meeting schedule for the subsequent year, the year we're in right now. When we found out that the location of the meeting was, in fact, owned by Mr. Lombardo, it was too late for us to move to another meeting location. We recognized that issue, and that in our mind it did raise a potential for conflict. We would not have met there had we known that before. We try to be aware of these kinds of potential problems. Unfortunately, in that situation, it was too late to make the change. But now that we're really trying to meet more often in public facilities, I think that will address the concern. But we're very acutely aware of it, and the incident last year really heightened our level of concern and the scrutiny we apply to where we meet.
Yeah. All right. Don Schmitz, 3 minutes.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Don Schmitz. I'd like to make a couple comments in regards to the comments made by Mr. Douglas and Commissioner Juan in regards to this documentary, which is out there with the inflammatory title. I was also interviewed for this documentary. When I was approached on this documentary, I asked what it was about. I was told it was going to be an analysis of the evolution of the Coastal Commission's policies as it pertained to brush clearance. I asked who was going to be on the documentary. I was told that Mr. Douglas had been interviewed. In fact, I was showed his interview. He looked very good, by the way. I was told that coastal commissioners were going to be interviewed. I was told that historical coastal commissioners, people that had been working on the commission in years past, were going to be interviewed. I was told environmental land use attorneys, environmental professors from different universities up and down the state were going to be interviewed on this. I was also told it was going to be a critical analysis in regards to your brush clearance policies. And I don't shy away from that. I'm always open for a good and honest debate about these things. I am interviewed on a regular basis. I've been doing this for 22 years now. I've been in local newspapers up and down the state, Los Angeles Times, the Sacramento Bee, Capital Journal. I've been in the Washington Times and U.S. News and World Report. I've been interviewed on National Public Radio and talk show all over the country. I've been on CBS News. I've been on CNN International News as it pertains to regulatory issues and land use policies. Sometimes I'm very happy with my quotes. Sometimes I'm not very happy with my quotes. Sometimes I'm very happy with the context of my quotes. Sometimes I'm extremely displeased. As public figures sitting on this commission, and that includes you, Mr. Douglas, I think that you would acquiesce that we don't always control these things. When I was approached on this interview, I was told that it was going to be a documentary. I suppose having watched the experience of some of the people in certain Michael Moore documentaries, I might have been more cautious and perhaps declined, but I did in fact become a part of that interview process. I have not seen the documentary. I have seen some of the excerpts from it, but I was not the genesis of it. I did not fund it. I did not produce it. I did not create it, and I am certainly not an egregious violator of the Coastal Act. So I appreciate, I know how valuable your time is, the opportunity to clarify things a little bit.
All right. Thank you.
We were just watching you on the monitor here, your interview. We just couldn't hear what you were saying.
All right. The next speaker is David Dilworth.
Good afternoon. David Dilworth, representing Helping Our Peninsula's Environment, or HOPE, so I get to accurately say at public meetings like this, I'm bringing you hope. Welcome back to the Monterey Peninsula. I thank you for coming here again, and I can't tell you how refreshing it is to actually hear an agency that cares about using the best available science. You may be aware that at the local level, that's not the case. And no, I'm not here to give you the normal update on the Pebble Beach Company and their doings or misdeeds, as I've brought you in the past, because apparently they are dealing in good faith with your staff, and we all hope to hear something good new in the future. So in that spirit, we actually didn't even hold a protest at the Pebble Beach Company gates for the AT&T golf tournament this year. I'm here to present a slideshow for you and pose a question. I'd like you to think about this while the slideshow is going on. What do these images have in common? Where do I point it? There we go. This is Sylmar Beach and the moonlight. This is moonset over Pebble Beach. This is just past twilight in Big Sur.
Isn't that great?
This is Garapata Beach, the north end of Big Sur, also in the moonlight. You might recognize the outline of Point Lobos, again at twilight. And that is two nights ago. That's a meteor coming down right over Point Lobos. That's a cloudscape from Sylmar Beach in Pacific Grove. What do they all have in common? They're all at night. Every one of the photographs was taken at night. They're all in the coastal zone. And all photographs were taken from areas with parking prohibitions preventing night coastal access. Pacific Grove, Pebble Beach, Carmel, and Big Sur, three out of four of these were done without your approval. Local ordinances that did not get Coastal Commission approval. Pacific Grove, Sylmar prohibits parking at night at Sylmar Beach. Pebble Beach, they closed the gates at Cypress Point. Carmel Scenic Road, you actually adopted things that prohibit parking on the beach, rather than just restricting it to 2 or 3 hours. In Big Sur, the entire coastline, you're prohibited because they're trying to prevent people from sleeping and camping. HOPE believes that parking prohibitions violate our Coastal Act, but we have a suggestion. What might be legal and fix the problem is restricting parking to 3 hours, and that would allow people to actually use the coastal access. So perhaps someone will be inspired to ask staff what we can do about this.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joey Ricano.
As he's coming forward, Mr. Dilworth does raise an issue that this commission has wrestled with over the years. And as he points out, the main reason the nighttime parking prohibitions are in place is because of the concern about overnight camping. And there's no prohibition from people going there. It's just that they can't park. You have to either walk or somehow get there in a different way. But it is an issue that this commission has wrestled with in terms of public access, and there is no universal answer to it. we look at it on a case-by-case basis and try to minimize impositions on restrictions of public access.
All right. Mr. O'Connell, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Neely. Honorable Commissioners, staff, and friends, my name is Joey Ricano. I'm the director of the California Ocean Outfall Group, and we are dedicated to ending all waivers of the Clean Water Act. We are currently working on the very last waiver in San Diego, and we hope that you won't be gun-shy from past experiences opposing that waiver, and give us some support when the time comes, because that waiver is going down. But today, I'm here to talk to you about some really fantastic news. And a while back, I came before you, I think it was in Oceanside, during the desal fiasco, and I asked you to consider sending a letter to the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board in support of having them acknowledge that the recent sewage spill by the California Men's Colony Prison in San Luis Obispo, which is the latest in a long line of Clean Water Act violations by that state facility, that there be a mention that there was a state marine reserve at the end of the Churro Creek. As you know, the Marine Life Protection Act created marine protected areas up and down the coast. That is an ongoing process. However, it started where I was in Morro Bay, and I had the good fortune to work with some great elected officials and local activists, and we did lobby the appropriate regulatory agencies, and we got a state marine reserve in the Morro Bay East Estuary. It wound up getting violated by the CMC not long after it became official. I think it became official in September of 08, they violated it in January. Well, with some fortunate lobbying of the governor's office, the MPA language was put into the administrative civil liability, and what wound up happening is we set a glorious precedent for the MPAs. The Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board did insert the MPA language, so it's in there in the ACL. So it's a matter of public record. And two great precedents were set that day. It was the 4th of February, and I was there in San Luis Obispo. And it was the first actual successful prosecution of a marine protected area violation. And then there was another one which was very important, which was it was a prosecution of chlorine. And so this is very important stuff, because chlorine can be very dangerous. It wreaks havoc with the environment. You had a conversation here with the about dioxin. Now, it's very dangerous stuff, the endocrine disruptors. Well, chlorine in the environment, when it chemically reacts with carbon, it makes endocrine disruptors. So I just wanted to know that, I wanted to tell you, you have another tool in your toolbox. And I thank you for all your great work, and thank you for this opportunity to address you today.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's our last speaker for public comment. And we have need for closed session?
Yes, and I would ask members of the public, please, to leave the room so that we can have the closed session and conclude the meeting.
All right. And I think what we'll do is let the commissioners have a 5-minute break while the public's leaving, and then come back for the closed session.
Be sure to come back.